John Bacon's new book, Fourth and Long, is subtitled The Fight for the Soul of College Football. That makes a book that includes a lot of fun sound very serious. John Bacon joins me now from WBEZ in Chicago. John, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Very early in Fourth and Long, you write that, and I'm quoting now, the world's first academically based athletic conference, that is the Big Ten, now stands as the last best hope for nationally competitive, reasonably clean college football to make its stand. In this context, what does reasonably clean mean?
Well, no one can claim at any level, I don't think, of college athletics, at least in Division I, that anyone's league is completely clean. Now, of course, in the Big Ten, only in the last two or three years, the three most stable, three of the seven most winningest programs in college football history, Michigan, Ohio State, and Penn State, all had to deal with the NCAA on some level and all had to fire their coaches. So right there you see that what used to be so stable is now a little bit rocky and, of course, a bit tainted as well. So that's what I'm referring to there as far as reasonably clean. That said, what's going on in the Big Ten, even on an occasional basis, cannot match what's happening elsewhere.
In your book, you celebrate the players at Penn State for the way they stuck together and played after the Sandusky scandal and the NCAA sanctions on the program. Tell me a little bit about why they deserve such praise.
Well, when you look at Penn State, obviously the Sandusky situation is not just a mess. It's a colossal tragedy, unlike any other I've seen or read about. And whoever helped them cover it up, Lord knows they deserve whatever they get, and that'll be meted out soon in the courts. But the players had nothing to do with this, obviously. Most of them, the vast majority, had no idea who Sandusky even was. And yet the penalties were theirs. And the reason the penalties were there, in my opinion, is because the NCAA is not an enforcement agency that's got a strict protocol that follows sentence guidelines the way our courts do. It's a marketing organization. If people are outraged, they will throw the book at you, whatever book might be handy. These guys were given every incentive to leave. You had coaches within 24 hours from around the country camped out in Penn State's parking lot outside their football building. There were players tweeting from inside the building like they're in a bunker saying, you know, was this the whole intention of the NCAA? We will not leave this building until these guys are out of the parking lot so we can walk home. And, of course, that might have been exactly the NCAA's intention. So with every incentive to leave and no real incentive to stay, no bowl games, no Big Ten title games, these guys, almost all of them, stayed anyway, which to me, Bill, showed they actually believe in the values of the NCAA more than the NCAA actually does. They believed in staying where you have a 91% graduation rate. They believed in staying with their teammates. And the spirit they showed during that season, and as you know, I was a fly on the wall in the locker room, team dinners, coaches' meetings, team meetings. I saw it all firsthand. It was one of the most dramatic sports stories I have ever witnessed.
I understand what you're saying. Still, wasn't the celebration of the football program at Penn State in part responsible for creating that determination to cover up what Sandusky had done in order to protect the reputation of the program?
That's a very good point, and a fair one, I think. Paterno did a lot of good, and the book lays that out. Now, the flip side of that is what you described. Once you have amassed all this power, and he got it the right way, in my opinion, then, of course, the last 10 years at least, he was hanging on to what he used to be. And sometime in 02 or 03, I believe it was Graham Spanier, the president at the time, who came over to Paterno's house to ask for his resignation, giving him one more year if he wanted it. So it was a pretty soft push out. And Paterno basically said, if you want my job, I'll have yours by lunch. And at that point, there can be no mistaking who's in charge of your university. So that's where the power gets utterly skewed. And if Penn State is not careful, it could happen again.
You maintain throughout Fourth and Long that historically, for reasons having to do with, quote, geography, affinity, stability, and identity, college football has been preferable to the football played in the NFL. How has that circumstance been threatened?
Of course, those are my beliefs, and those of us who love college football much prefer it to pro game for those reasons. The people who love college football truly, the players and the fans, and this amazing relationship between them, which in my opinion is far closer than any relationship between any players and fans in any league anywhere, that relationship is threatened by the guys who run the game, who seem to have less and less in common with the players and the fans who love it. Look at, for example, the Notre Dame-Michigan rivalry was ended with an envelope passed from Jack Swarbrick, the Notre Dame athletic director, to Michigan's athletic director, Dave Brandon, 5 minutes before kickoff, which legally means they've got 3 games left. We can break the contract with 3 games notice. It was all about greed. Is there a single Notre Dame player or Michigan player or fan on either side of that fence who said, please end this rivalry between the two greatest programs in college football? If they're saying that, I didn't hear it. All right, the ADs don't care. They don't care what you want. They don't care what the players want. They're going to move kickoff times anytime they want. They have the teams plan Thursday nights. They're going to change uniforms on you when they feel like it, if they can sell a few more Adidas or Nike or whatevers. And they don't care.
One of the most compelling conversations reported in your book involves Tim Brown. As a player at Notre Dame, he won the Heisman Trophy back in 1987. Then he had a long and successful career as a wide receiver in the NFL. Were you surprised about which experience he valued more highly?
Not in the least. It was interesting to see him spell it out so clearly. As you noted, I talked to him in the press box of the Notre Dame-Michigan game. And a very nice guy and very, very sharp. And I said, hey, which experience did you like better? He said, Notre Dame, no question. And he recounts to me a little scene where he's wearing his gown. He's back in his room, his apartment, sitting on a box of books, saying to himself, I have just graduated. I do not want to leave this place. Even though the other side of that fence, Bill, is a whole lot greener in terms of money. I mean, it's millions of dollars. The guy's an NFL borderline Hall of Famer. He might make it one day. And I've talked to Archie Griffin at Ohio State. I've talked to almost any NFL player will tell you that. And it's really quite striking. This is, again, my point. The players and the fans love college football more than the people who run it.
In the epilogue of Fourth and Long, you highlight friends of yours who refer to college football by saying things like, you keep getting abused, you know you should swear off it, but you can't get yourself to let it go. And another guy says, I'm just about through with Michigan football. Why did you decide to end the book on that negative note?
Because I feel kind of like I'm looking at a wonderful national park that is on its way to becoming Niagara Falls, that you got this natural beauty. It all occurred organically. Almost all the traditions of college football were started by the fans or the players for each other, not, you know, for some marketer. And it's real. It's authentic. And I see it. The souvenir guys are getting in there, and it's not too far, unlike Navy Pier that I walked through to get here to WBEZ. It's a tourist trap. If we lose that spirit now, we have got about, I think, 3 or 5 years to save this thing from becoming completely run over and basically a bona fide minor league. Once that happens, you can't get it back, man. Once the Asian carp are in the Great Lakes, you ain't getting them out. They're like that. So it is cynical. It is obviously negative. But it's real. And the guys you quoted are friends of mine since junior high school. As I say in the book, these are not just canaries in the coal mine. These are the coal miners. And if these guys are hacking and wheezing, the air in there is not good. And Michigan and others should watch out. Penn State, by the way, they've lost 3,000 season ticket holders a year the last 4 years. And 2 of those are before Sandusky. When you're losing those guys, watch out. This thing is a lot shakier than you think.
John Bacon is the author of Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football. The book is published by Simon & Schuster, and the author joined me from WBEZ in Chicago. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
You're listening to Only a Game.